It seems like everyone is either starting a side hustle or becoming their own boss. And you know what they're hearing a lot? It's the sound of another sale on Shopify, the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business. Sign up for a £1 per month trial period at shopify.co.uk/sell23, all lowercase. Whether you're selling loafers or peace lilies, Shopify simplifies selling online and in person. Covering all sales channels, from a shop front POS system to its all-in-one e-commerce platform, Shopify even gets you selling across social media marketplaces. With their 24/7 help and extensive business calls library, Shopify is ready to support your success every step of the way. Go to shopify.co.uk/sell23 to take your business to the next level today. That's shopify.co.uk/sell23.
Hello and welcome to Baseball America's Draft Podcast. It is Carlos Clauza joined by Peter Flaherty once again for the first time in a long time. Peter, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. We've had a lot happen since our last recording. We've crowned a national champion in Tennessee. We've had some crazy coaching moves across the college baseball landscape. And
yeah,
the draft cycle is kind of at its peak. So there's been really no shortage of action since the college season has actually ended, which is both a blessing and a curse.
Yeah, I mentioned this on a recent podcast I did with Ben Badler for Future Projection, but it is a bit frustrating that, like, at the peak of the draft season and kind of when everyone's super interested in what we're doing, it's also like the most difficult to consistently record podcasts because we're both so busy with various travel and just the massive amount of content that we need to finish both for the magazine and the website. So apologies for how long it's been since we've recorded. I know we kind of got into a little bit of a weekly groove there in season. That was a lot of fun. So thank you guys for bearing with us just for missing a few weeks here in June. June is typically the biggest painful month in terms of like getting out regular podcasts. So sorry for that. I'll probably take most of the blame for that one, Peter. I know you probably could have recorded most of these weeks in the past, but what have you been up to over this last month? I know you're watching the Cape, which to me feels insane. Just because like there's so many events going on for 2025 and we're still a few weeks away from the draft. And I've really been bearing down on some like mock draft reporting and just making sure 2024 is lined up as accurately as possible. But we do have the next cycle already starting. So what have you been up to? What's been going on in Peter Flaherty world?
Yeah, it's been a blast. So college season finished up covering that, and then shifted focus immediately towards all things draft and Cape coverage being down here. And it helps both getting looks at guys trying to improve their stock a little bit heading into this year's draft. Guys like Austin Overn, Thatcher Hurd, and a host of others are up here. And then it also, you know, you have the best 25s and 26s in the class. And I caught a handful before they went to USA, and then another handful are coming back. So it should be a good rest of the summer. And then the transfer portal, trying to somehow cover that has been a little bit of a daunting task because you have over 5,000 names in there, and then we're trying to sort their reasoning for or decipher their reasoning for entering. So it's, you know, the draft guys that you can kind of pick out are entering from a leverage standpoint, like Thatcher Hurd, who just recently entered. That's a break in case of emergency type of deal for him with going back to school. Same thing with Jansen Kiesel or Luke Hayden or a number of others. So it's been a fun challenge trying to get some sort of power ranking together of the guys in there. And then there are a lot of notable 2025 and 26 eligible guys in there as well. So just trying to keep a grasp on the game in general has been my main goal over the last handful of weeks. But really excited for day one of the draft in 11 days as we record this and 10 days as you're listening to this, or maybe 9, depending on when we release it. But
yeah,
I'm very fired up.
Yeah. So actually tell me a little bit more about like covering the transfer portal and what your thoughts on like what that's been for just college baseball and just the challenges of covering it, because you are much more involved in that than me. I'm like very tangentially related to it or not related to it at all. Kind of just like read what you write and try and follow it based on what you're hearing. But it does seem like such a crazy space and hard to manage. So like, what's the process for you for keeping up with it?
It's almost, excuse me, it's almost impossible. And I think the unlimited transfer rule, basically it's so bad for college baseball. It's just awful. And I think where if it's like this and there's no change, it's going to have to get worse before it gets better, which I don't even know what getting worse would even look like. And it's just insane trying to keep up with it. Like dumping 10 new names into the running like transfer portal rankings we have each week is almost impossible. Like there are
yeah,
so many like quality players that are in the portal. And like I mentioned, like you have to decipher why. So it's like, you know, it's pretty easy to pick out when a kid's just entering for leverage. And then you've also got to make sure that the underclassmen are well represented and all of that. So it's literally just like the wild, wild west. As a Division I or any level coach, if I were trying to keep my team intact in today's game, like I'd have no clue what to do because not only are kids entering just willy-nilly, like there are everyday starters entering, there are kind of the guys that you can pick out who would enter that are entering, but there's almost no rhyme or reason as to who's hopping in the portal. Like you can't really rule anyone out in today's day and age. Like there are guys from major programs who are on the cusp of Omaha or in Omaha and were part of that team's core that hopped in. So it's like if I'm a mid-major coach at a really high quality mid-major, like how am I keeping my team together?
Yeah.
And it's just so fascinating and kind of unfortunate to watch because it creates this domino effect as well, where again, if I'm a coach at a hypothetical, really high quality mid-major program, like I'm not going to want to send my guys to play during the summer on the Cape because of one, like the way it is now, you see the entire third base line and first base line behind the plate just lined with college coaches, including the usual number of scouts. But it's just all coaches up there watching guys in the portal, trying to get guys in the portal. And
yeah,
I know trying to get guys in the portal sounds slimy, but there is rampant tampering going on. I don't think that that's a real secret. I know that people don't really want to talk about it, but
yeah,
there is encouragement and nudging to get into the portal and guys being contacted by schools that aren't yet in the portal. So
what are the actual rules for contact with transfer portal situation? Like what is allowed, what's not allowed? Because I probably like the fact that players can leave and transfer. For me, it's not as much of a negative as I know you're not a fan. Like I just think if coaches can up and leave and take huge money to go to a different program, like the players should have the freedom to do the same. I know it does create a lot of chaos in terms of just like understanding what kind of team you're working with. And I do think like specifically this time of year when coaches not only have to worry about the transfer portal, but they're also trying to figure out which one of their recruits are like a threat to get drafted. Like they're trying to figure out who's going to be drafted and signed, who's going to make it to campus, trying to balance that with their players who are like already in school. Like there's some sophomore eligibles and juniors who are also in that fringe range where like you don't know if they're going to get drafted high enough to go, and just juggling all the roster dynamics and then throwing in the transfer portal to add even more chaos. I'm entirely with you. I would not want to be a college coach trying to decipher it all. But I do think it like is reasonable that players can go where they want like any other college student. But like, do you know what the like what the no-gos are in terms of tampering? Like what's crossing a line, what's even allowed, how does this actually work in practice?
That's a great question. I think I think if you're going by the book, you're not supposed to talk to a kid until he's like officially in, but like everything, you know, they'll find a way to get in touch with you and talk about what a potential NIL deal could look like and all this stuff. So it's not really like groundbreaking info to hear that coaches are talking with kids before they enter the portal. But
yeah,
I'm with you. It's such a tough line to toe because you don't want a kid to be trapped at a school. But like some of these guys are transferring for the second time in as many years. And it's just like, it's just so strange to see, and such a far cry from, not to be like the old man yelling at cloud,
but it's such a 25-year-old Peter, old man yelling at cloud.
I was just like eating hot dogs and chewing gum at these games. But it's such a far cry from what I feel like college baseball was even like 5 to 6 or 7 years ago. The change has been drastic. So I think there needs to be some sort of middle ground. Like, yes, kids should be able to go where they want to go. You know, as you mentioned, just how coaches should, but there has to be some regulation where it can't be this basically free agency period.
The NCAA does not seem to be well positioned to regulate much of anything these days, it doesn't seem. So to your point about it being the Wild West, it's definitely the case. The one element that also is interesting in this new like NIL world are high school players who withdraw from the draft. Like Derek Curiel is the most prominent so far to withdraw from the draft. So he's ineligible to be selected. I'm sure he like had a good feel for where his draft stock was at this point. And we've had players in the past, like Dylan Cruz is probably the best example of a player who like, as an underclassman, was a no doubt kind of first round looking talent, slid a little bit, LSU commit, ended up, this is 2020, so maybe there are some COVID implications there for Cruz. But either way, similar deal, withdraws from the draft. Great get for LSU. And I wonder if, so from like my perspective, I know we talked about this in Slack a little bit, but like, I don't really see the benefit of a high school player withdrawing from the draft, because in MLB's draft, you don't have to sign. Like if you go and you get offered the amount of money that you think is worth taking to avoid college or to pass on college and go pro, you can do that. If you get drafted and you don't get the amount of money you want, you can still go to college. There's really no downside. But I do wonder if now with NIL, there is an ability for players who are withdrawing to maybe get some compensation for that from their colleges via the NIL, because from the college coach's perspective, you're getting a little bit more certainty and kind of roster construction and holes you need to fill, getting players to campus. I wonder if that's going to become more of a factor for teams who are just trying to navigate the portal and navigate these new rosters in a really tight window. Maybe that could be like the first actual like tangible benefit that I see of players withdrawing early. And I'm not sure if that's a factor now, but I assume it will be increasingly a factor moving forward for these big programs who just want to get their priority players to campus.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And think if it not already is, like when you mentioned guys like Derek Curiel, I think it will just become more and more of a factor. So I don't know. It's just going to be really interesting to see how the game keeps on progressing over the next 1, 2, even 3, like in the short term. It's just going to be pretty fascinating to watch all of this unfold, see how it could potentially be regulated, and then see the effects it has across all facets. So like getting these highly coveted high school guys to campus, potentially, like how, you know, like how highly coveted can you, the way I'm phrasing this is awful, but like, can you start pulling in like the mega fish, like Connor Griffin or Bryce Rainer? Like, can you start getting those types of guys to campus? I don't think it'll ever get to that point, but it will be interesting to see, because I think the idea of NIL and all of that is extremely appealing to any high school kid or big time recruit.
Yeah, it's interesting with like those heavy hitters. The NIL is going to have to reach a crazy level, because like just looking at slot values, like top 20 slot values is all greater than $4 million. I don't know the exact numbers that people are getting in the SEC and NIL, but I can't imagine it's quite reached that point. And I know that I've even talked with some college coaches who are just like asking what the slot values are in like days two, like just to see like the like slot values being like $500,000 in the fifth round for like, trying to figure out like what the NIL money comparison needs to be for that. Like with the slots rising, with bonus pools rising, this year was an 8.7% jump in slot values and bonus pools. That's going to keep going up. So kind of that competition between slot values and what teams can offer in the draft versus what these like programs that are investing in NIL can offer players is just going to keep increasing. It's great for the players. It's maybe more not so ideal for MLB teams and college coaches trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, with the NIL stuff, you hit the nail on the head. Like it's not quite at the like approaching the bonus level, at least for these high round talents, but it is surprisingly, I guess, higher than you'd think for some of these programs with some of the players that they're talking to and offering. Like it kind of make you go like, wow, okay, with some of the numbers these guys are being offered. But I don't know, I'm interested to see if any of it becomes more public going forward. I doubt it will be, but like there have been, the figures have been tossed around, like with Braden Montgomery and Texas A&M and some other guys, but nothing concrete. So just pretty fascinating in general.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, let's talk about some specific players. Is there anyone in the Cape that has really just jumped out to you initially and wowed you, whether that's a 2024 draftee who's getting a little bit more reps before the draft, or really any kind of player who's been the standouts for you so far early in the Cape season?
Yeah, so I guess sticking with, for now, 2024, just kind of working on down. Austin Overn, notable name, USC outfielder, also former wide receiver on the football team. He's shown really, really well up here, hitting 373 through 13 games, hitting 373 with four doubles, a pair of triples, and two home runs with nine RBIs, four bags. Like, the freshman year Austin Overn, when he was going really, really good, is back. And I, when I saw him, I was really encouraged to see that he cleaned up some of the moving parts in his swing. Like, there's no more toe tap, his hands don't drift as much. Like, it overall is a lot more of a cleaner look in a direct path to contact. And the hand speed is really, really impressive. Like, I hardly had any time to set up my video camera because on the first pitch of the game, he hit a absolute mammo out to right center field.
That's awesome.
And it was still rising as it went into the trees. And then he's a difference maker with his legs. He's an elite level athlete. I think that the routes in center field will hopefully continue to improve, but he was like he looked the part of a nice, like, fourth to sixth round guy, early day two for me.
That's super encouraging because Overn is a player who, I think entering the year, there were some people who wondered if, like, he could perform well enough to push himself into, like, a day one status, maybe get into the second round. Cause like you mentioned, the athletic foundation, the speed foundation, the defensive profile that you're looking at is super exciting. And he just had a down offensive season. He didn't perform early on. It looked like scout feedback that I had early on suggested that he was really pressing and struggling. He hit 270 this spring with USC after hitting 314 as a freshman when he led all Division I hitters with 14 triples. So 13 games in the Cape, hitting for more power on like a rate basis than he ever has in his career at either USC or his previous stint with Orleans in the Cape is really encouraging. Two homers in 13 games, a couple of triples, four doubles. That's really encouraging. And the fact that you also are like noticing a difference in how he's actually getting it done in the box, and it's not just maybe some like small sample size noise, like there's like a material change in how he's doing it, is massively exciting.
Yeah, there was I left the yard that day really encouraged and excited about Overn, kind of how I felt when I was first catching on to him as a freshman. Day one is a little rich, but if that's a guy like in the mid to late fifth, if he's still there, I'd happily pull the trigger. I think there's upside and there are tools, most importantly. So I was happy with him. And then on the pitching side, one guy that stuck out to me, at least initially, and he's not as notable a name as Overn, but looks like he'll be a day two guy in the 8 to 10 round range, is Rutgers left-hander Donovan Zach.
Yeah.
Double TJ guy, so the health track record is less than encouraging, but lanky, kind of wiry lefty with some effort in his delivery. But the fastball was up to 98 from the left side with serious life through the zone. Like, it wasn't 98 coming in on a tee. Like, it jumped out of his hand. It was, you know, again, super, super lively. I think that the strikes are still a little bit of an issue. The pitchability is still a little bit of an issue, but keeping that in that same breath, like, Zach is a guy that I think he really just has one season of college experience. So as he gets into a pro org and in a legit player development system, the pitchability and polish should come. So, like, he's an arm that it's fun to kind of dream on the upside with him, because I think that there's a lot to tap into with him, both in terms of, you know, you've got the now stuff to work with. He's an athletic left-hander. There are a few boxes right now that he checks, and he's still got to check a couple, namely in the pitchability department, but in establishing himself potentially as a starter. But I liked him. That was an interesting look. And then kind of,
yeah, he's the, just to jump in here on Zach really quickly, is he's like the perfect example of a player who benefits from this later draft date. The fact that he can come in and get a little bit more reps in the Cape after not pitching a ton in his college career. Like, I'm sure some teams were intrigued with his stuff, even based on like a solid season with Rutgers this spring. But for us, like, he was one of the most prominent up arrow players in our most recent update that kind of is folding in some of this early Cape stuff. And the fact that you're a left-handed pitcher that has been up to like 98-99 is exciting from kind of a lower slot as well, or a lower release point.
Yeah, and the fact that he's left-handed as well, it also, you know, it plays in his favor. And I guess a kind of not an opposite arm, but like, he's also left-handed, also from the Big Ten, is Minnesota's Connor Wickriff, also on Bourne, interestingly enough, in his two starts, allowed just one run across 11 innings, 12 Ks to one walk. The pitchability and polish are absolutely present with Wickriff. I was really, really intrigued with what I saw in my outing. It's a lot of strikes. The stuff isn't as thunderous, but it's not like completely vanilla. Like, he's got a swing and miss breaker. Fastball's got a little bit of life through the zone. And he really, really filled it up. And so, like, again, I'd happily take that in rounds 8 to 10. So, I liked him. And then an arm that was eerily similar to Wickriff was Merritt Beaker, maybe a tick down when it comes to stuff, but won MAC Pitcher of the Year this year at Ball State. Fastball, 89-91 with some arm side life through the zone. The slider is his best secondary offering. He'll backfoot it to righties, kind of expand it and lengthen it against left-handers. He can land it for strikes. He can backdoor it. He can front door it. His feel for the pitch was really impressive, but for him, for me, it's just continuing to refine the third pitch, which is a changeup. It'll sometimes get a little firm and straight at times. I think if that can continue to take positive strides forward, he could be an effective back end of the rotation starter eventually.
Yeah, there's several names that are really encouraging and exciting. Nice to see that. There'll be some players that are going to get paid probably after a few good turns in the Cape Cod League, showing some stuff, showing some pitchability. So that's fun. You know, I've still never been to the Cape, Peter. Blame you for that, because you're always there. So there's
you got it covered. You got to get up here. It's legit. It's baseball heaven. And the environment that you can watch, like, every single team across the league, regardless of how the standings look, is supremely talented and chock full of really, really fun players. And I think what makes it so cool is every single field is a very intimate environment. Like, these guys are, for better or worse, under a microscope, and you can, you know, you see everything, you hear everything. You know, you can get a really good feel for who this player actually is. And I think, yeah, it's just, it's very, very cool. And the games are all free, and there's really nothing like it elsewhere in the country in terms of both summer leagues and collegiately. Awesome. So it's a blast. And then on the hitter side, one more I wanted to circle back on was Austin Pease, John Gazdar.
Yeah.
I know he kind of popped off. Well, didn't kind of pop off. He had a really good year this year for the Governors, as did almost everyone in their lineup. But bat to ball skills and field to hit are really impressive with Gazdar. He's always been that kind of bat to ball merchant, but he got into some more, tapped into some more power this spring. That's carried over into his 14 game stint so far on the Cape with Hyannis, hitting .321, really similar K to walk, three doubles and two home runs, still flashing the feel for the barrel. It's a little bit of a unique operation with how he does it, with a really high handset. They drop and drift a little bit in his load, but the hand-eye coordination is exceptional and makes up for what could potentially at times look like a little bit of a lengthy operation. Like, the hands are really quick through the zone. He's consistently on the barrel, and he handles himself really well at second, but he's also played some short and third.
Yep. I was going to ask about that defensive profile, because he was a pretty regular everyday shortstop for Austin Peay in the spring, but like you mentioned, he's kind of played all over the infield. Where do you view him best at one spot, or do you think he's going to be a guy who kind of is just this utility type infielder?
Yeah, second base for me, but you could absolutely play him over a shorter third for a couple of games or a game whenever you need him. He would more than handle himself over there. So I like him a lot. He can run. It might be a little bit more of a performance over tools profile, but with the one tool being a borderline plus hit tool, I think that's going to serve him well as a good anchor. And then,
yeah, and him being 22 years old on draft day too, I think he could go in like a surprisingly high spot depending on like how teams view him as a priority senior sign type. We've got him ranked currently in like the 200 to 250 range on the BA board, but I feel like in terms of like where he could actually be selected, really anywhere on day two makes a lot of sense to me.
We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. What I love about Indeed is how easy it makes it. I post a job. I get the responses. I can search for them, sort them, analyze them all in Indeed. Then I can contact, set up interviews, do it all within Indeed. It makes it easy. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Whether you're playing or coaching a doubleheader or you're a fan in the stands, I don't need to tell you that we're sweating through yet another hot summer. And whether you're playing or watching, hydration is key. Liquid IV is extraordinary hydration for physical endurance, mental clarity, and overall well-being. A single stick of Liquid IV delivers better hydration than water alone, with 3 times the electrolytes of the leading sports drink, plus 8 vitamins and nutrients. I love to hop on my bike and ride at the end of a workday. Before I do, I tear open a stick of Liquid IV, add it to my water bottle, and stir it up. It's that easy. 15 seconds, and you've unlocked better hydration. I'm currently partial to the sugar-free white peach, but there's a flavor for you, whether it's strawberry lemonade, raspberry melon, lemon lime, and it's easy. The sticks fit in your pocket. You can add flavor, electrolytes, vitamins, and nutrients wherever you go. Turn your ordinary water into extraordinary hydration with Liquid IV. Get 20% off your first order of Liquid IV when you go to liquidiv.com and use code BA2022, that's BA2022, at checkout. That's 20% off of your first order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code BA2022 at liquidiv.com.
AI might be the most important innovation ever. It's storming every industry, with literally billions being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs the right data and a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? Time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud, Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, and application development, with AI embedded across it all. And Oracle Sovereign Cloud helps you address your requirements for location, access, and data residency. OCI provides blazing fast speeds for AI's demanding workloads. And in the cloud, when you pay by the minute, speed matters. And of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. If you want OCI to help you do more and spend less, like Uber, the Premier League, and Oracle Red Bull Racing, take a free test drive at oracle.com/bandwidth. That's oracle.com/bandwidth. oracle.com/bandwidth.
I think so too. Ranking wise, that makes sense. And that's where he fits perfectly. Round wise, I could see like 5th to 7th. That wouldn't totally floor me to hear his name called that early. And then one more guy. I'm trying to think of a draft eligible guy to bring up, because
you don't got to force it. We can do some underclass guys if you want.
Yeah, I guess we can change a pace here to the underclass guys. And I might be a little bit of a prisoner of the moment here with who I'm going to talk about, but saw him last night, and it's Cody Boker from he's headed to Vanderbilt this spring by way of Georgetown. He's been outstanding for Orleans so far, across 15 and a third innings. He's posted 1.76 ERA, 17 Ks to one walk, and another guy where it's a pretty enticing combination of strikes and stuff. He hides the ball really well. Fastball, 91, 93 was up to a 4 with some life at the top of the zone. Mixed in a cutter that was really effective and he could land with strike, that he could land for strikes. And then also a sweeping slider with some teeth that he got a lot of swings and misses on. So a guy that to me looked the part of a no doubt starter. I think next year going to Vanderbilt, he's going to be a really, really good arm for him. And he looks like he's got, you know, top five round upside.
Mm-hmm. Who is this name again?
Cody Boker, was at Georgetown this year, transferring into Vandy. Really, really liked him last night.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think as well. Brewster has a guy, he's under the radar right now, chose not to enter the portal, and he definitely could have and gone to a major, major school, so I will have a soft spot for him for that. Mm-hmm. And it's Nick Dumanil, center fielder from Cal Baptist. My first look was not great at him. He started off really slow, like a lot of guys do coming up here. It's a pretty big adjustment and a far cry from playing with metal and against not as talented arms, I'd say. So rough look first time around. Got him again last week, and it was the polar opposite. He went 4 for 5, hit a laser solo home run out to dead center that was maybe 18 feet off the ground. It was a really impressive swing, and outstanding athlete, 6'2", 205. Like, you look at him up close and in person, and like he's huge, but not like a bad huge, like just a really freaky looking athlete. And I mean that in the most complimentary way. And this is a guy where there's no shortage of tools. And I think right now he leads the league with 12 bags. And he's also got 3 doubles to his name, a pair of home runs. I think the key with him going forward is shoring up the hit tool and refining it a little bit. The pitch recognition skills, especially against spin, aren't great. But I think, you know, if he can shore that up, that'd be huge. And playing at Cal Baptist, there's no doubt he'll have another unbelievable spring next year, where, you know, this season he had 362 with 19 doubles, 19 bombs, 45 RBIs, 9 stolen bases. He's just a really, really toolsy athletic player, top potentially like 3 to 4 round guy. And that might be being conservative on it.
Yeah.
I think there's legit day one upside with him.
That's awesome. How would you like, what is your view right now of the 2025 college draft class? I was asking Ben what he was thinking about 25s and 26s on the high school side, since he spent a lot of time over the last month. Like, do you have any early impressions on how this class stacks up, or what your excitement level is for the group?
I think it's interesting. I think I'm more excited now that, like,
it's always fun when they're fresh and new, right?
Exactly. Like, to turn the page and to talk about these guys as the upcoming class, I think I'm really excited for that in general. On the pitching side, I know that Smith and Burns will be a really tough combo to replicate, but I really wouldn't sleep on Tyler Bremner or Jamie Arnold. I don't know if they're going to be...
These two, I mean, I could be wrong, but these two seem like they fit the more kind of classical starter profiles of top of the class college arms, whereas with both Hagen Smith and Chase Burns, they're kind of just more of the stuff monster variant. Is that true?
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, again, Burns stuff wise is pretty much unmatched and will be unmatched for as good as Bremner and Arnold are. But from, like, I am not as at all really concerned about Bremner or Arnold being able to start and potentially headline a rotation.
It will be nice next year looking at a couple pitchers who, like, are fronting the class in terms of college pitching arm talent, and you look down and you see their, like, career walk rates are in the 2 to 3 per 9 range instead of the, like, I guess I'm going from walks per 9 to walk percentage, but looking at guys like I was just talking about Hagen Smith on a draft podcast recently, and they were like, you know, his walk rate is like 10%. Is that, like, considered good or bad? And I was like, you know, in this class, it actually might be considered pretty decent, whereas typically it's not great. So it will be nicer if next year we don't have to write as frequently about the reliever risk of the college pitching demographic in general. And those two seem to be starting it out on a pretty solid page in that area.
Yeah, those are two guys that are going to headline the class on the pitching side of things. And then positionally, like I'm really excited about it as well. You know, the guys at the top that are being mentioned in Cannarella, Lavalette, Bodine, Devin Taylor, like that's a really, really good quartet. And Gavin Turley arguably has the most, not as much as Cannarella, but you know, he's a really tooled out guy at Oregon State. And when it's all clicking for him, the good looks really, really good for him. Trent Carraway is the most prized sophomore eligible guy. Mason White, if he just cuts down on the strikeouts a little bit, you know, he's another really fun player. So I think that in just an initial scan, even at the top of the board, like there is plenty to be excited about. And then even as you make your way down, further and further, like there are guys that this summer who have established themselves as, or really even over the course of the spring as kind of household names in that 2025 class. So, personally, I'm really excited for it.
It will be nice to dive into another class, but let's briefly touch on the draft that's about to happen in a few weeks. I will let you jump in if there are more players you want to mention from the Cape, but kind of wanted to talk briefly about kind of how this class is standing now, what we're hearing a few weeks out, if there's any clarity that's happening at the top of the draft. We recently released Mock Draft 5.0 at the beginning of this week. Pretty similar from what we've had a few weeks ago. I don't think there's a significant amount of new information in the class. It's the same group of 10 that seems to come up at the very top. Christian Moore at Tennessee, just given the College World Series run he had, is getting a little bit more buzz in the last few weeks. I think there's a chance for him to move inside the top 10. James Tibbs is another hitter who I know you like, Peter, who also has a chance to do the same thing. And also on this recent mock draft, I'm just kind of scanning down it, Peter. I've got Nick Kearse and James Tibbs side by side, and I know that's long been kind of your take. You would take Tibbs pretty close to Kearse in this draft, but unfortunately it does not seem like we're getting any clarity in who is going one with the Guardians. Their pool of players that they're considering there still seems fairly wide, which means the teams beside them have an even wider net of players. So there's a lot of chaos still. I would say like the one maybe biggest change in information or what seems to be coalescing is inside of our group of 10, there are five names who seem more commonly talked about at the top, and in no particular order. That's Charlie Condon, Travis Bazzana, J.J. Weatherholt, Jack Caglione, and Chase Burns. So if that counts as like any new material or new insight into the draft, maybe that clarity of like those guys being more likely to be the top five adds to it. But it still feels fairly wide open to me as we're basically like a week plus away from the draft, which is not ideal if you're in a position where you need to make mock drafts and try and create some confidence in what's happening. I try and say as often as possible that there's plenty of uncertainty and not try and overstep like how confident I am in any picks, but that's kind of where we're at this stage.
Yeah, it's suboptimal, but I think it also, you know, it's a little fun where it's like you have this unknown and you can dream on a couple of guys going 1-1 to, you know, if you're a Guardians fan. And
I think the Guardians fans are kind of driving themselves crazy because there's a lot of camps that have really been defined and people are Team Bazzana or Team Condon. And I've seen a few people who are like intrigued by Weatherholt, but I know there's a lot of like anxiety about the thought of Cleveland taking a non-Condon, non-Bazzana player and mixing the pool around. But definitely if you are just a fan of like watching the draft, the chaos that we could have this year is going to be really good from just like a pure entertainment perspective.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. And you can shed some more light on this, but at least like there hasn't been a ton of new developments over the last handful of weeks since the college season ended. Like you said, Moore has kind of established himself as a likely top half of the first round guy, potentially a dark horse top 10 guy.
Yeah.
But there seems to be more smoke and steam around Weatherholt going 1-1. And I'm curious what you've heard on that front.
Yeah, so that was like in Mock 4.0 several weeks ago. It was kind of the, I don't remember how long ago really it was at this point, maybe like a month. But I think we had that, we put Weatherholt there just because there was a little bit of smoke to it. And then since then, I've only heard that more. And every time we're in mock season, I really wonder how much of this information is like cyclical. And because I put it in the mock draft, there are people who like are adding more to it than maybe there should be. Like how much of that is just getting funneled like right back to me versus like there's actually more like truth to it. But I definitely have talked to people who think Weatherholt could be the Guardians guy. I know that he's like a player they're interested in and are really considering. It does feel like to me from like my perspective, or again, I'll acknowledge that there's a lot of uncertainty here. Weatherholt and Bezzano just feel like the two most likely players at this stage. I do wonder like where Charlie Condon winds up on their model, because he is younger than both those players. And it does seem like there's at least an indication based on the players they've targeted in the past few years that they've started to put more of a priority maybe on power and exit velocity. And certainly Charlie Condon's numbers there would grade out really well. But the fact that guys like Jack Caglione and Connor Griffin continue to be linked with Cleveland at one, like players who do not scream Cleveland Guardians to me, for a few reasons, like the fact that they're still linked there just adds more uncertainty to it. Today, as we sit here recording this podcast, I would say Weatherholt and Bezzano seem most likely, followed by Charlie Condon. But man, it really is difficult to know. And if they are taking the strategy of like trying to figure out who their top options are, if they kind of find their like three or four players who they're happy with and just send out offers to them and see who takes the lowest, like, I mean, it's almost impossible to know who they're taking until they've done that. And that's going to happen very late in the process. So I don't really anticipate feeling much confidence with who is the final mocked player. But there's really been no reason for me to go with anyone other than Weatherholt and Bezzano at this stage. So it's kind of how it is.
Yeah. And I mean, for better or worse, whoever ends up going one, you're not going to be very far off with whether you're right or whoever ends up going two of the bunch. But I am, as we've said now for, I'd say, the better half of the cycle, I'm really curious to see what it looks like.
Yeah.
The mid top 10 and then getting into the teens and beyond, because that's where it could go a lot of different directions. So
yeah, I think there are a couple teams that I would just like point out right now where it really feels like they're either pivot points or teams that could really shake the draft up quite a bit. The first, obviously the first is Cleveland, just because the ball is kind of in their hands and they're going to decide everything up top. But the White Sox at five, it feels like they are considering a lot of different profiles. I've assumed it's going to be like college bat for them. And I think there's a lot of scenarios where a college bat, they like falls to them at five, but the fact that some high school players have been linked with them could open up a little there. At number eight for the Angels, everyone in the industry continues to link them to fast moving college bats, just given what they've done in the past few years. One name linked to them in our most recent mock draft that I'll dump here in the podcast is prep left-hander Cam Caminiti, who is definitely not in that sort of fast moving profile and would be an interesting change of pace for draft strategy for the Angels. But they're a team who are also consistently linked to potential underslot guys, players who are further off the board who could maybe jump in and mix up this kind of consensus top 10 tier of players, whether that's a guy like Christian Moore, whether that's a guy like James Tibbs. I do think it's more likely now that a player like, whether it's Connor Griffin, whether it's Nick Kurtz, whether it's Brayden Montgomery, maybe one of those three has a decent chance to slide outside of the top 10 and get to like a Tigers or Red Sox or Giants. And I'd imagine all of those teams would be really excited to have a chance at one of those players. Yeah. Then kind of scanning down beyond that, it's just going to open up really rapidly. Once we get to, I maybe would extend it to around 15 or 16 at this point, because it does feel like guys like Christian Moore, Trey Savage, James Tibbs, they have kind of, they feel like they're going to be the first players off the board after this top 10. But there's going to be chaos at some point. And beyond that group of players, it's really hard to separate anyone with a lot of confidence.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating with just who could go when and where and the dominant, like if Brayden Montgomery falls out of the top 10, like anyone would be just, I think, jumping at the opportunity to add him. And even just scanning further and further down the board, like there are some guys like ranked outside of the top 50 right now who I personally really like Kyle DeBarge for one.
Yeah.
Shortstop from Louisiana. I think that he certainly has a chance to go on day one, potentially really, really high on day one. Kavaris Tears just really established himself as, I'd say, like a third to fourth, third to fifth round guy in the College World Series with how well he performed. Dylan Dreiling, dark horse, potentially not really that much of a dark horse day one guy. It's kind of like
interesting to see how many day one guys Tennessee winds up having.
I know I wrote a story last year about Wake Forest and, mm-hmm. and how many day one guys they have. Maybe it should have been Tennessee, but yeah, they have a chance to have a handful. And I think in that same breath, like Dylan Dreiling is another interesting one. It's almost like a left-handed Ryan Waldschmidt, not necessarily from how it looks, but from a profile standpoint, left fielder.
I like that a lot.
Yeah, left fielder professionally, plus hit, potentially plus power, at least to the pull side on the right day. I think there's some more explosiveness with Waldschmidt, at least in the operation, and probably some more power in general. But Dreiling certainly tapped into it a lot this year, and the added impact served him well. So that's a hit first, a guy that you're going to really have to be pounding the table for his ability with the bat. To take him on day one. But if that's a guy that's around for your third pick, that's a really high quality ad when you're talking about Dylan Dreiling.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm still really curious as to what the order of this college catching demographic is going to be, because based on some of the potential landing spots for guys like Malcolm Moore and Walker Yannick, and then Caleb Blomavita more typically being the guy who the industry feels like is going to come off the board. But they're all close enough together that I think you could really, on draft day, depending on how things unfold, wind up with a ton of different orders. I don't know if you're still solidly in like the Lomavita as your catcher one camp. I really like Walker Yannick and would have to think really hard about those two. But I'm curious to see where these catchers go, how many wind up going in the first round. I think we've got a chance for three catchers in the first. But that kind of player grouping is fascinating to me as well, because they've just been so... I wouldn't say it's as difficult as like this middle tier of college hitters, but they have been interesting to try and line up this spring. And like a month ago, it seemed like Walker Yannick was getting a ton of steam, might be the first hot the board. The last update, it sounded like there was a chance he could slide a little bit further, and Malcolm Moore was getting a little bit more up arrow steam. So just how that group unfolds, I think, is going to be really fascinating too, and something that I'm looking out for.
Definitely. And I might be in... I might be in the Walker Yannick camp with you. I know he was someone that we talked about, I guess, reasonably early on, as he was formerly kind of a guy that was pushing himself into day one. Now he's solidly in the first round, I think, but just a really impressive profile overall with him behind the plate. There aren't a ton of holes to poke with him. And I guess similar to Lomavita, like, he is a sneaky athlete. Lomavita is probably a better athlete, but I wouldn't sell Yannick totally short. So I think it's really close between those two guys at the top.
Yeah. We had a chance to interview Walker Yannick on the Hot Sheet this week, actually. So you guys can see that on YouTube. It was a really fun interview. And I think, I don't remember who asked the question, but he was asked like which pitcher was most difficult for him to face. And he cited Cade Overmuller from the Cape last summer. So he thought that was the toughest matchup, that low slot, like riding fastball slider combination. So that was kind of a cool interview. He talked about his background as a catcher, the one knee setup at the plate. It was a really fun interview. So I'm excited to see where he goes.
Yeah. Well, one, definitely go check that out. It's on YouTube, and it also airs every Tuesday at, I believe, 3 Eastern. It's just awesome. So make sure you're subscribed to the BA YouTube channel so you don't miss a really cool episode like that. But you can always go back and watch. But with Yannick, yeah, it was cool. It was cool to see him say a guy from the Cape. And I do not blame him for saying Cade Overmuller. That's a really, really tough look for right-handed and left-handed hitters alike, especially left-handed hitters. But
yeah, he specifically said that was the first time that he had like felt the shock of a wood bat when you get really jammed, I think he jammed him and he got him on the cap, so his hands were not feeling too great after that matchup. But he did get a hit off of him, so that's
there we go. Man, I think my hands would just be broken. But after those two, it does get really interesting, because you start talking about guys like Malcolm Moore, Jacob Cozart.
I wonder how high Cole Messina is going to go. Because
I was going to say, you can even throw in Cole Messina, and that feels like a guy that has a lot of momentum right now, especially after how he finished up the season.
It wouldn't be shocking to me if Messina wound up going ahead of Cozart, just given the strength of his season offensively, kind of hearing about how sneakily good he is as an athlete, some of the advanced like framing metrics on him in college. Like, there are a lot of things that he really does well. Yeah, I think both like Cozart and Messina have a chance to go in a pretty good spot, and like the more I look into Messina, the more I'm really intrigued by the profile.
Yeah, and I've kind of long been like maybe the lowest of everyone on Jacob Cozart. Like I'd take Messina above Cozart. Cozart for me is he's a fourth to sixth round guy. I know that's really harsh, but
you're still just bagging my guy that I drafted in our initial preseason catcher draft. So I know you just want to keep hitting me over the head with that one.
No, hardly. I don't know. I just can't get in on him. I'm curious to see where he ends up going.
Yeah.
I would kind of be surprised if he makes it. I'd be kind of stunned if he makes it into that range. Actually, he won't. But that's just a more personal preference thing. Like for me, guys like Yannick and Loma Vida are just, and Malcolm Moore, I guess you could even throw in there, just so head and shoulders above him for me. I don't know. But yeah, that's another a fun little side plot to it. And I guess also as well, like the lack of middle infield depth collegiately is striking, I would say.
Yeah, that might be a good like point of interest for Caitlin Culpepper. Like, I don't think he's a slam dunk first rounder. If he doesn't go in the first round, I don't think it's going to be too long after that when he gets his name called. But I know there are some teams that are kind of in the middle of the first round who are intrigued by him, who also have second picks right after. So kind of where he goes and whether or not like filling that vacuum of confident middle infield profiles on the college side will benefit him will be really fascinating as well. We might have fewer. I'll be interested to see how many players are selected as shortstops who are not likely long-term shortstops, but we might have fewer shortstops drafted in the first round this year than like many drafts beforehand. I'm very curious to see what the number winds up being.
Yeah, it's not going to be a lot. And I think in just scrolling down the board a little bit, I wonder how high guys like Kyle DeBarge or Jalen Flores could end up going. Especially DeBarge. I think that's,
yeah,
a really interesting profile in general, both offensively and defensively. He's a really good athlete. Offensively, there are a lot of tools and I guess upside packed into his pretty compact frame. So kind of a personal cheese ball of mine. And then I guess in a similar breath, it's just been really interesting to see, I guess, interesting in not a great way, what's happened with Anthony Silva.
Yeah.
Over the course of the last 365 days, like, I saw him like a week and a half ago on the Cape. Like, the offense was really rough. The defense surprisingly was also rough. Like, I was, I just kind of left perplexed. Like, I just have him go back to school, honestly. Like, I don't.
And he is an eligible sophomore, so that feels like a more realistic outcome for someone like that. But I mean, what you saw is very consistent with what I've heard from a lot of Texas scouts, where he had this great offensive season in 2023, probably better than was expected of him, given his reputation coming into school as like this glove first shortstop. And then, yeah, this year, just really tough early on offensively. I think he rebounded a little bit, but it was still a light offensive season. And then the fact that this player who our scouting directors entering the year had dubbed as like the best defensive infielder in the class is now getting questions about how he's doing things defensively. Does he have to move to second base? Like, I think highlights just how tough his year was in general, and also just the scarcity of convincing shortstop profiles in this year's class. Like Griff O'Farrell might wind up going in a pretty decent spot. He had a better year. I'm still a little bit skeptical that he's like a shortstop long-term, just given the arm strength. But I know there are scouts who think that he's definitely going to be a shortstop moving forward. So I don't think it's some consensus opinion that he moves off the position. So it'll be really interesting to see like the capital of middle infielders in this class and who's going in like the top five round range and which profiles teams decide to invest in or pass on.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the thing that was most striking about Silva was the lack of defense, maybe. Like, I didn't think it was crazy impressive this spring at TCU. But then like when I saw it live, it was just kind of like, whoa. But being a draft eligible sophomore, I think for better or worse, it does play in his favor where he's got this added leverage. Like, he can go back to school for another year pretty easily and work on what he needs to work on if a team doesn't quite meet his dollar amount. So I think being
not
a little
the same years, but have a little Corey Collins season. Corey Collins had his draft stock fall after his first 3 years and then really just figured things out. Something clicked this spring and now he's going to go to a pretty decent spot. So maybe he can just have that bounce back year, get some more confidence and ascend back up boards if he doesn't choose to sign this year.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Cool. Any other players you want to mention or things you want to talk about before we get out of here, Peter? I think we're kind of nearing the end of the show today, but if there's anything you want to mention, I'm happy to chat about it.
Nothing on my end. I think when we reconvene next week, it'll be can touch on some more 2025s and 26s that have impressed up here on the Cape, and then any new draft stuff, because there are a lot of impressive underclassmen that have been showing out up here.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. All right. Sounds good. Well, that'll do it for us today. Glad to be back on the mic with you, Peter. Thank you guys for listening. Thanks for following Baseball America in general. Definitely check out the site. There's tons of new content. We had a new top 100 drop as of the day of this recording of the podcast. So that's up there if you want to see where the minor league prospects are going. Both Peter and Jeff have had some really good Cape coverage. That'll continue as we move forward. And then any sort of draft information you want to know will be on the site and ready to go for draft weekend. And we are really, really close now. So thank you guys for listening. For Peter, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.